Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you this November 23rd, 2008 on WILL AM 580. Today we have as our guest someone who's probably been the most frequent guest in the history of our program over the last 6.5 years. And we'll be talking about the election, the results, the current politics in the United States and the world, where we go from here. It should be a wonderful show with John Nichols. But before we go to John Nichols, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
A new report by Media Matters for America documents how conservative talk radio shock jocks are part of an echo chamber that reaches across the country through local and regional radio hosts. Gioni Palmer, National Press Secretary of Media Matters, says that the report focuses on right-wing radio's misinformation related to the election and shows that this network of radio hosts made a concerted effort to smear presidential candidate Barack Obama and denigrate various groups, including immigrants, the poor, the LGBT community, and people of color.
We hear comments that are made on talk radio that would never be tolerated on TV or never be tolerated in newspapers.
He loathes America.
He's palling around with terrorists.
You're a far-left, terrorist-hugging politician.
He's Arab.
What are you going to do, Obama? Come to Denver and try to whip my white ass?
Palmer believes in free speech and says the talk show hosts have a right to say what they want. But he insists others have the right to criticize and debate what is being said.
Those airwaves that they're on, those are the people's airwaves. Those were lent by us to them to use it. And so they can say whatever they want to say. It's sure. And we also have the right to be critical of what these folks say. We're just asking people, when you hear something that you don't like, be critical of it and let that voice know. That's free speech, too. That's the First Amendment. That's democracy.
The Statue of Liberty is crying. She's been raped and disheveled. Raped and disheveled by illegal aliens.
I'll give you an example. I don't think homeless people should vote, frankly. In fact, I'm not that excited about women voting.
When you hear this kind of stuff, you need to let your voice and your opinion known. We want people to be civic activists when it comes to their media. The same way that you would write a letter to the editor if you saw something in the newspaper that you didn't like, we want you to write a letter or call your local radio station when you hear something that you don't like or that offends your sensibilities.
To read the report, Radioactive Smears, go to MediaMatters.org. And now, a commentary by Free Press Communications Director Craig Aaron.
I'm sure by now you've heard the news. Dems set to muzzle the right. The plot to drive talk radio off the dial. Or any of another in the endless series of articles warning that if Democrats take power in Washington, they're going to hush the Rush Limbaughs of the world by reinstating the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was a long-standing, if seldom enforced, regulation that required broadcasters using the public airwaves to present contrasting viewpoints on controversial issues. It was taken off the books by the Reagan administration in 1987, but now shrill warnings about its imminent return are red meat for the right-wing base. Here's the truth. The Fairness Doctrine is never, ever coming back. But that's a good thing. The Fairness Doctrine never fails to rile up the ditto heads. Reading op-ed pages and blogs or listening to some of the conservative talkers, you'd think the Fairness Doctrine was the top item on the Democratic Party platform. But no serious policy advocate in Washington is pushing to restore it. No bill to bring it back is moving through the Democrat-controlled Congress. And President-elect Barack Obama has stated unequivocally that he, quote, does not support reimposing the Fairness Doctrine on broadcasters, end quote. Political imbalance on the radio dial shouldn't be blamed on the doctrine's demise. The real culprit is runaway media consolidation. The biggest companies like Clear Channel and Cumulus have swallowed up hundreds of local stations, shuttering newsrooms and supplanting local talent to pipe in the same cookie-cutter, mostly conservative, content from coast to coast. Media consolidation is why local news and musical variety are disappearing from the airwaves. It's why so many of us, regardless of our political persuasion, think the radio just seems so much worse than it used to. That brings us to the best reason of all to abandon the fairness doctrine. There's a much better bipartisan solution. Both the left and right widely agree that the corporate media is too concentrated and ignores local needs. Instead of policing content, Congress and the FCC should adopt policies to increase the diversity of owners, the choices for listeners or viewers, and the opportunities for new voices to get on the air. Rather than trying to limit the range of opinions, we should be working to foster as many alternatives as we can imagine. The public debate we should be having is about how well the media are serving our communities and bolstering our democracy. The Fairness Doctrine? It's just a distraction.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you today, November 23rd, 2008, just 3 weeks or so after the 2008 presidential election. And we have as our guest probably the most suitable guest for us to have to talk about politics, electoral and otherwise, the editor, political editor, Washington editor, editor of some sorts.
Yeah, I just say,
correspondent,
I just say
writer,
political writer.
Political writer. I think that's the best description.
Yeah.
This description for you. Political reporter for The Nation magazine, also for Madison, Wisconsin's Capital Times daily newspaper, none other than John Nichols. John, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be with you, Bob.
You know, we were going to have you on for a special show 2 days before the election on November 2nd, and you were called away to London and Dubai to give sort of expert analysis of the election for the BBC and Al Jazeera. So we couldn't have you on that show, regrettably. We were fortunate to get, I think, David Sirota to sit in.
You did, and you saved me from making bad predictions. So, it was you know, it's those pre-election shows are very fun to do because you're in the midst of it and the excitement and the intensity of it. But the, you know, in many ways, I prefer the period we're in now because, you know, right on the edge of an election, you know, it's very hard to get away from the horse race.
Yeah.
That's really what you're about. And appropriately so, and I was too. Once you get beyond the election, then we start to talk about what elections are really about, and that is a competition for power.
Yeah.
And we are now in the period where we're starting to see what happens when you win an election. You know, the progressives haven't won an election in this kind of way in a very long time. Let me just give you the briefest sense of what happened on November 4th.
Okay.
Barack Obama became the first Democrat to win the presidency with more than 50% of the vote, over 50%, since Jimmy Carter in 1976. He was the first Democrat to win the Electoral College with a substantial victory, some kind of over 50 votes, a real wide, solid margin.
Yeah, by many states.
Yeah, since Lyndon Johnson in 64. He was the first Democrat to win the presidency, come in with substantial margin, popular vote, more than 8 million, more than Reagan's margin in 1980, as well as substantial electoral vote win and dramatic boosts in the House and Senate since Johnson in 64. So this is something that progressives especially need to kind of take a deep breath, step back, and realize they actually won one in a big way. And I think that even the Obama camp, to some extent, has struggled with this, struggled with the recognition of the fact that Barack Obama was not merely given the presidency. He was given that which politicians always seek, and it is a mandate to actually do something.
It's ironic you say that because it seems like since the election, the incoming Obama-elect administration, either through its own volition or through the conventional wisdom being pushed upon it or a combination of both, has sort of adopted this view, well, we have to govern to the center, sort of like we barely got in and we've got to placate our opponents to show what nice guys we are. And it just strikes me that there's this double standard. I mean, when George W. Bush wins an election in 2000, and he doesn't even win
the election. With all due respect, he didn't actually win.
Yeah, no. And even if he'd had won Florida, he lost the popular vote by 600,000. You know, if George W. Bush comes in, he governs like, you know, he won like a 1964 caliber landslide. And you know, no one said, well, you should really govern to make Democrats happy since you didn't really win or you need their support.
Yeah, I mean, you know, can you imagine, for instance, in 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected president with a smaller popular vote margin than what Barack Obama has won and with a smaller percentage of the overall vote than Obama has won, because of course you had, he beat Carter by a lot, but you had John Anderson there running a relatively successful third party race with a bump in the Senate, no doubt, but I would note no bigger than the bump in the Senate that Obama's gotten, and with the House staying in the hands of the opposition party.
Yeah.
Now, Ronald Reagan did not come in with any apologies.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he arrived and said, well, you know, I got just over 50% of the vote, and the House is still very Democratic.
I got a lot of labor voters, so I better be nice to labor unions.
Yeah, I better really, you know, trim my sails here.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was the opposite. He came in and said, look, I've been elected to govern. The challenge with the Obama victory, I think, is even more complex than some others in this sense. John McCain was right about something. He was right when he said that Barack Obama was a relatively new player in Washington, had only been in the Senate for, you know, when he started running for president, barely 2 years, and had already been kind of positioning for this national stage. So he's not a man of Washington. And the unfortunate reality is that as he's been thrust into this position of having all this power, this mandate, he seems to be turning very much to the traditional Washington Democratic crowd rather than bringing in a lot of new faces. And look, bringing in new faces doesn't always work. Jimmy Carter brought in a lot of new faces. It didn't work very well. But you would have, I personally would have liked to have seen a little more of a mix in the initial picks.
Well, you know, it's hard to avoid the idea that we're getting a third Clinton administration to some extent when you see Rahm Emanuel brought first hire, chief of staff, is really going to be the one person who has daily constant contact with the president throughout the 4-year administration.
Yeah, and anybody who knows Rahm Emanuel knows that he is even different than the average chief of staff.
I mean, he's a gung-ho dude.
Rahm Emanuel is just a force of nature. You can love the guy or hate him. Ideologically, I have a lot of differences with him. But the truth of the matter is there's nobody that kind of bursts into a room and takes it over the way he does.
And his politics are, you know, on the right side of the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's over there not far from Joe Lieberman.
Well, I think there's a couple things to understand. First and foremost, he is a social liberal. Abortion rights, gay rights, a host of other issues. He may actually be a little more liberal than Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more for gun control, something like that.
Yeah.
On foreign policy, he's a neoconservative.
Yeah.
He is actually very, very closely aligned with a view of the world that's not radically different than that of a mainstream member of the Bush administration or of Lieberman or somebody like that. On economic policy, he's sort of an outlier, a complex mix. When you get into the international components of economic policy, he's a free trader in the classic sense, pro-NAFTA, pro-China free trade. On domestic policy, he's maintained relatively close relations with labor unions and that. So he is a mix. I wouldn't portray him as a Lieberman in the sense that he is dramatically more of a partisan, more of a loyalist.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be showing some initial signals of being willing to do Obama's bidding, even if it's something that he doesn't necessarily agree with. We saw that on a decision about putting Colombia free trade into an economic stimulus package. That would have been a classic thing that Rahm Emanuel might have done, but he said that we're not for it.
Yeah.
Obviously channeling Obama there. So he's a complex player. And really the way to understand Emanuel is this. He's not the problem. If Rahm Emanuel is allowed to dictate foreign policy and trade policy and things like that, it will be because Barack Obama chose to have him do so. On the other hand, if Rahm Emanuel is really the enforcer for Obama, telling other players, you know, look, you got to do this, but from Obama's perspective, and Obama retains a progressive perspective, Emanuel is not that big a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our, at least my hope is that you know, Obama is a strong enough figure that he selected this guy.
And chief of staff is not a policy-making position.
It shouldn't be. It
shouldn't be.
No, this is
unless he pulls a Dick Cheney and sort of
famously, you know, this is I wrote a biography of Cheney, and the chief of staff has some powers that people don't think about. For instance, in the White House, it determines where your office is, mm-hmm. and they're constantly the White House is huge, and they're mm-hmm. constantly rearranging the walls and things like that. And when Cheney was Gerald Ford's chief of staff back in the 70s. He got really upset because Ford had brought in some of his congressional aides, and he gave one of his congressional aides an office right next to the Oval Office. So this guy was quite liberal, kept wandering in talking to Ford. This drove Cheney and Rumsfeld nuts. And so Cheney, under the guise of fixing the plumbing, put a wall where the guy's door was, so he couldn't come into the Oval Office. To get into the Oval Office, he had to come through Cheney's office.
Vintage Cheney.
But this is, you know, look, I wouldn't rule that out with Rahm Emanuel either. I'm sure he's already looking at the plumbing charts and stuff.
Our guest today, John Nichols. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580 coming to you 3 weeks or so after the presidential election. We're going to be talking electoral politics and post-election politics, especially today here on Media Matters. We recorded this show about 72 hours before going on air on Thursday, so please don't call in today. That we won't be taking phone calls. Sit back, relax, and let John Nichols and yours truly do the yakking for today. You know, John, on this subject of the shape of the Obama administration we're seeing in the weeks following the election, we were talking before going on air about how during the Democratic primaries, especially early on when Obama was trying to make a name for himself and distinguish himself from the pack, the defining issue for Obama was the war in Iraq. It was that he was the one candidate, actually, of the leading candidates who had been formally opposed to the invasion before the invasion. And he rode that horse throughout the primaries against Hillary Clinton, with the distinguished thing Hillary Clinton is really politically on foreign policy, you know, partial neocon. She's not she's not really out there where the heart and soul of the Democratic...
An evolving neocon. Yeah.
But, you know, the heart and soul of Democratic voters certainly was against the war, and she was not with that tide, and he was. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that was a crucial element that gave him the edge in Iowa that then gave him the ability to be the front runner.
There's simply no question of that. And one thing that people need to remember is that as regards how somebody gets to the presidency, of course, the first step is winning the nomination. You don't win the nomination, you're going to happen. And while it is fair to say that Barack Obama was elected president this fall because he was a Democrat running on relatively populist economics in a bad economic moment, there's no doubt of that. But to get to the point where he could do that, he had to be an anti-war candidate. And so you have to look back a year ago now. If you go back 1 year ago when they were fighting like crazy in Iowa, polling
and Hillary was the big favorite at this point.
She was the favorite, although Obama was coming up.
Yeah.
But so was Edwards. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was polling showed at that time that, if you can imagine this, that the war in Iraq was as big an issue for Democratic primary voters as was the economy.
Mm-hmm.
This was a different moment, and nothing else even compared. And so the war in Iraq became this really central factor. And in Iowa, where the Democratic Party is disproportionately kind of old school anti-war, mm-hmm. really strong, almost isolationist sentiment there, Obama spoke to that directly. His campaign clearly distinguished him not merely from Hillary Clinton, but from John Edwards.
Who had voted for the war
while in
the Senate.
Edwards had even apologized for his vote, and yet they still said, this is a judgment call. Who in 2002 got it? And they played those tapes and mm-hmm. released those transcripts of Barack Obama going to an anti-war rally. Not just speaking up on the floor of a legislative chamber, but actually standing with the anti-war movement outside, yelling in, don't do this. And so there's no question that tens of thousands of Iowa caucus goers and millions of Democratic primary voters in those early states made the choice to support Barack Obama in significant part because he was the anti-war candidate.
Which now brings us to the interesting development of the past week. We don't know as of today the exact outcome. We do know that Barack Obama has offered the Secretary of State position to Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton. All the inclinations are she will accept it, mm-hmm. but that's not locked in as of
it's
yet.
The truth is there's a negotiation going
mm-hmm.
on, and the negotiation does not have to do with Hillary Clinton. One of the things that those of us who covered the campaign knew from very early on was that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton actually liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
For all the churn and all the ugliness, campaigns do get ugly. That is the nature of it. You're fighting for the most powerful position in the world, and you're being told by people you have to say something. You sometimes do. And so it got a little nasty there. But the truth is that Obama and Hillary Clinton had each other's cell phone number. They talked on a regular basis. They frequently protected one another. Remember, there are points where the Clintons were really being accused of going over the line on race issues, and Obama, in a key public appearance, said, I don't think Hillary Clinton's a racist. I don't think she's doing that. Similarly, there were points where Hillary Clinton talked it down.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a good working relationship, and one that does not make this all that shocking a choice.
Well, I mean, the point I'm getting
the problem
at...
is Bill. No, okay. I'm saying in a negotiation,
the
concern is that Bill Clinton has been a really aggressive player internationally and fundraising for himself and his library. And so we know that that's the key part of the negotiation at this point. It is not a negotiation about where will Hillary Clinton stand on foreign policy. Barack Obama knows that. And in fact, if you looked at Barack Obama's evolution as a candidate, he moved a long way away from a lot of that early anti-war messaging during the course of the campaign. He and Clinton are now on a pretty similar page as regards Iraq, and unfortunately, I would say, as regards Afghanistan. They both tend to be supporters of moving a lot more U.S. troops into what looks to me an awfully lot like Vietnam in the waiting. So I don't think they're a long way apart from
that. No, I think, in fact, what the selection does is it sort of solidifies what seemed apparent from May till November in Obama's own position on the war as he moved away from being an anti-war candidate to being, well, I can manage the war a little bit better, and I'm more than willing to start new wars.
And I may dial the war down a little bit,
or I'm going to
dial another
one up. Yeah, I might dial another one up.
There's another component of this, too, that's important, and that is that a lot of people don't fully recognize the extent to which Hillary Clinton is respected as a Washington player, particularly on foreign policy. And I heard this from a very liberal senator, Russ Feingold, who had traveled in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan with Hillary Clinton. And he said he was absolutely shocked by the intense level of respect for her on the ground by all sorts of players across the ideological spectrum in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Obama, in fairness to Obama, well, I'm certainly not a Clinton defender, I think he looked at that reality and said that of the various possibilities for Secretary of State, this is somebody who can actually help me more than most. And I think that's why she's probably going to get the job.
Our guest, John Nichols. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We taped this show a few days before going on air on Thursday, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let us do the yakking here in WILL AM 580. John, I want to talk a lot more about the fundamental policy issues and political debates that are going on right now that are so important to the future of the country and so important, in fact, for the survival politically of this administration. But before I do that, a couple more political matters I do want to touch base on since, politics is in our bloodstream. The U.S. Senate now stands at 58 to 40. They're doing a recount in Minnesota. Franken has at least a 50-50 shot by most expert analysis of pulling that one out, but it will be close no matter who wins. It might probably be under 10 votes. And then there's going to be a special by-election down in Georgia in a couple weeks to determine that seat, which conceivably could take the Democrats to 60. A lot has been made of why 60 is so important. Can you explain why it's considered so important and whether you think it actually is that important?
I do think it's important. And I've been in debates with people about this. It's funny, I was on a radio show not long ago where I was debating, and I found myself in the bizarre position of defending keeping Joe Lieberman in the Democratic caucus. And I've been a critic of Lieberman going back to 1988 when I was more sympathetic to Lowell Weicker, the Republican, than Lieberman. So it's a long time critic of the guy. But this is how important 60 can be in a Democratic Congress, in a Democratic-controlled Senate. If the Democrats have 60 seats and they can rely on that 60, or even maybe lose one but pick up one moderate Republican like Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, they have the ability, A, to approve every judicial pick. They don't have to struggle with it, negotiate. They can appoint people to the federal judiciary, have them go through a Judiciary Committee session and then vote on it the next day. You can get Supreme Court picks through with a real fluidity and a real ease that no president has had. No president has had in modern times.
LBJ didn't have that?
No. Well, that's, I'm saying that's for most, okay. For many of our listeners, that isn't necessarily modern
that's
times.
That's medieval times.
Yeah, okay. That's a long time ago. And but it's been a long time since a president had that kind of leeway. And even LBJ struggled on some court picks because some of the Southern Democrats wouldn't go with him because of civil rights.
The skeptic in me says, is there any reason to think Obama would take advantage of that? I mean, looking at his cabinet picks, he's picking people who a vast majority of Republicans have no qualms with.
I give you that. There's some evidence that Obama, former constitutional law professor, and Biden, a former constitutional law professor, outgoing constitutional law professor, have a real interest in the courts and might do some pretty good stuff there. Mm-hmm. Remember, the most important court appointments are not to the Supreme Court, but it's those dozens
appellates
and dozens
and
of federal judges.
Yeah.
So that's very, very important. For all the people who whine about the courts during an election season, 60 mm-hmm. is the number you ought to care about. Because mm-hmm. that's a number where you can appoint a liberal, and no matter how much whining or objection there is, you can actually get that.
But as you said, if you only get 58 or 59, and the administration's popular, a big and, mm-hmm. There are going to be Republicans coming up for election in 2010 who don't want to be seen as the obstructionist.
It's not life and death.
Yeah.
But it is important. And let me tell you one other point. That was just, we talked about the appointments. The other place where it is very, very important is on one of the subtler initiatives of this administration, but one that completely freaks out the corporate right, and that is the Employee Free Choice Act.
I was going to ask you about that.
This is labor law.
And explain that to our listeners. We've mentioned on the air before, but just in passing, because for a lot of, it didn't come up in the campaign, surprisingly, mm-hmm. but for a significant number of voters, this was the defining issue of the campaign.
Well, this is a very, very big deal. Labor unions in the United States have a harder time organizing than in any supposedly free country on the planet. Just about everywhere else in the world, if you want to organize a labor union, if the majority of people on a work site, you know, sign a petition, sign a card saying we want this union to represent us, you're there. You're done. You're in the game and you start representing them. And that goes to an immediate negotiation on, you know, the parameters of representation, how you do the contract, all that. In the United States, it's different. In the United States, you get the 50% to sign cards, a petition effectively, and then you set up an election where management knows who has signed up to be a supporter of the union, and they start putting people on third shift. They start laying people off. There's all sorts of aggressive moves are made to defeat the union
stories.
In the election.
And the classic, you know, we have a mutual friend up in Wisconsin who was involved in organizing a Walmart, an effort to try to make that a union shop, and they had a majority assign the list. And then he tells me, for 3 months, basically, you have management bring people in and talk to workers individually, say, if there's a union, we will close the store.
Yeah.
So basically 3 months of just, you know, harassment.
And or, again, laying people off. I mean, there's also things that are technically
illegal. So it makes it impossible, realistically,
to
start a union.
It has stalled labor union organizing. You know, we always hear, oh, unions are dying. We're down to 10% in the public sector, 10% in the private sector, 12% in the public. Well, unions aren't dying. Unions are being, you know, roped up and prevented from moving forward.
So the Employee Free Choice Act will basically mean once you have a majority of workers want a union, they
can start representing them.
Yeah.
And then if the workers want out, they can also petition their way out too.
Yeah.
It's a very democratic thing. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, corporate sector, a lot of Republicans despise this thing. And I'll tell you, that's one of the reasons this comes up under the parameters of a discussion about 60 senators, because I will suggest to you that on that issue, you will have, if possible, a united Republican opposition, even some of the moderates, because the fact is that unions are awfully key players at election time. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very hard. It can be very, very hard to get any Republicans to come over. And so if you've got 60 Democratic senators and they're committed on this,
mm-hmm.
or at least 59, and maybe you get Specter, who has run at times with labor support, getting in that parameter, the 60 vote, is really what's going to define whether we have labor law reform in the United States and whether for the first time in decades, unions are able to be on the march rather than be in the corner.
And so the difference for standard of living of workers, all the statistics show, it's night and day.
This is a big deal. And again, I always think that what an administration does on policy is often less important than what it does on structure.
Mm-hmm.
Does it create a new playing field that allows good players to go in there and achieve things? The Employee Free Choice Act is one of those classic playing field structural moves.
Now, John, you know, one of the issues that also came out with this election is there's a lot of talk about, are we in the midst of an epochal generational shift in political power in this country, similar to the Reagan election or the New Deal or these long periods where one party and one philosophy dominates? So even in the Reagan era, while Clinton was a Democrat, he played on their terms. He's playing on their field. He was responding to a very Republican era throughout his 8 years. And the evidence, I think the most striking evidence for this, and there's lots of it, as you know, more than anyone I know, you know this evidence, but the most striking evidence is under 30 voters going more than 2-1 for Obama. Even Reagan did not approach 2-1 in his races. I looked it up because he's bested was 60%, and this is so it was more 3-2, and it, you know, it's stunning. If you're looking, you're sitting in the Republican shoes, this is not the sort of stuff you want to see. Your voters are older and dying, and
your
whiter.
Voters are older and dying, and also people who didn't used to vote are voting.
Yeah.
And they're voting in disproportional numbers. Understand this, that Barack Obama achieved some amazing things on Election Day. He didn't just get young people out to vote. In fact, the truth of the matter is young people did come to vote, but they didn't come in nearly the numbers that I think some of the Obama people hoped for. They were there. They were a higher percentage, but there's still an awful lot of work to get young people engaged with the political process. What was fascinating was that groupings that have been moderately engaged were much more so. Latinos, much big bump in turnout there. Asian Americans, big bump in turnout.
And both went heavily Democratic.
Well, this is the interesting thing. In the primaries, these groups, Latinos and Asian Americans, went quite heavily for Clinton. And there was some sense that Obama might have a problem there.
Yeah.
He didn't. He was getting very high percentages. So here you see this fascinating thing. The classic old school Democratic voting blocks, African Americans, Jews, union members, kind of coming back in big numbers for Obama, voting, coming out in big numbers and voting in high proportions, but also new groupings, Asian Americans, Latinos, coming in big numbers along with the young people. So is this a generational change?
Well, let me add one other group that I think is really, if I were the GOP, I'd be most concerned about, not that they're going to call me up for advice. Not that I give it to them either.
I'd give it to them.
I would actually give it to them.
What the heck?
But, you know, a close family member of mine who's been an independent voter, voted for as many Republicans as Democrats, and I think fits the model of the sort of suburban, upper middle class, professional person who oftentimes votes Republican. Mm-hmm. That's been the backbone of the party before the religious crowd came in.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he told me he wouldn't vote for a Republican again in his lifetime because they were lunatics. He thinks they're like religious crackpots and also economic extremists who have no idea how to run an economy. Mm-hmm. And so he's like the base voter of them. He's none of these other constituencies, and he's now completely alienated from that party.
Well, look at the example of this. And within the lifetime of people who voted on November 4th, you saw the complete transformation of a region of the country, not the South. South actually sort of come back for Democrats. They won a couple states. They won some key Senate seats. They've won House seats in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, places like that. No, it was New England. In 1936, Franklin Roosevelt's great reelect, 1936, the joke was, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. The two New England states that voted for Alf Landon, they voted Republican against all the other pressures of that moment.
Yeah.
Well, now New England does not have a single Republican member of the U.S. House. For the first time since the Republican Party was started, the legislatures across the region are overwhelmingly Democratic. The senators from the region, to the extent that there are Republican senators from the region, are liberal Republicans, you know, Snow and Collins from Maine.
Yeah.
And so all of the indications are that, you know, kind of old school Republicans are beginning to move out of the camp. This leaves the Republican Party with a base of voters that essentially is extremely socially conservative, anti-abortion, anti-gay rights. They accept a kind of bizarre 100% pro-Wall Street economics, mainly because of a taught hatred of government.
Yeah.
And so corporations good because that's the alternative to government.
Because that's what their minister tells them.
Essentially. But this grouping, remember, let me tell you how isolated this grouping is in our politics. We had a number of referendums on the abortion issue, which is really the core issue of the religious right, on November 4th. And the religious right lost in South Dakota. They lost in California. They lost everywhere in the country where you had an abortion-related issue on the ballot, places like Western states, a whole bunch of them, very conservative places, they lost. And so what we find out is that this grouping is really down. We're talking in a range of like a 32, 34, maybe if you push it and soften some of the edges, 40% base for the Republican Party. That is not an electorally viable base in any part of the country.
And as you know, John Nichols, I look, if you look at the electoral map for compared to 2004 and 2000, which counties have trended more Democrat or more Republican, it is an astonishing map to look at because basically you have the Appalachian Mountain region going more Republican, then trailing down into Arkansas, Oklahoma, and North Texas and northern Louisiana. And that's it. That's it.
It's the only part of the country. And here's the interesting thing. Obama and the Democratic Party chose, by and large, to neglect those places. You know, the Oklahoma, the funny thing is that unlike in the past where Democrats in vast stretches of the country, the interior West and the South, down-ticket candidates ran away from the ticket.
Yeah.
The Oklahoma Democratic Party, where Obama did very, very badly and the Democrats did very, very badly this time around, they were begging Obama to come in. Mm-hmm. They wanted him to come.
Yeah.
They, in fact, the chairman of the Oklahoma Democratic Party said, if Barack Obama had come to Oklahoma and done a couple of events, we probably could have upped our turnout enough, not to win the state, but to look a lot better. The fact of the matter is that there is not a 50-state strategy. Right now, the Democrats have maybe a 38 to 40 state strategy. They accept that there's 8 to 10 states that they just don't play in.
And next up, I mean, just on along those lines, it seems like ripe for the taking right now is Arizona in the very near future, maybe Montana in the very near future, Dakota's right after that, and then the big kahuna, which will destroy the Republican Party, Texas.
Yeah, Texas is probably still, you know, there's this sort of like demographic race on Texas.
Yeah.
You know, what year does Texas flip?
Yeah.
I mean, when do working class Latinos, and if you look at those border counties along the Mexican border, overwhelmingly for Obama. But when do working class Latinos, African Americans, and you know labor union whites kind of get together in this coalition?
And the sort of the northern suburbanites who move in, like in North Carolina and Virginia.
But do you know where it's going to flip before that? It's interesting. I think, and it's one of the kind of runoff elections. Obviously, this Senate race. I think Georgia.
Hmm.
Georgia. I was blown away by the map of Georgia when you looked at that. Obama and Jim Martin, the Democratic candidate for the Senate there, won counties from the Atlantic coast all the way over to the Alabama border and from north to south. They didn't win all the counties, but Democrats were winning in places where they have not won for a very, very long time. And what you saw two things going on in Georgia that are very, very significant. I think it's this eastern seaboard strategy. And because also South Carolina. Much closer than anybody
43% expected. 43% Obama.
Yeah, and Democrats doing very well in a lot of races there. I think you essentially have the situation where the combination of, in those southern states, a lot of African Americans, if you mobilize them, get them to the polls, that's important, with a lot of northern retirees coming and settling in those coastal regions. This is transformative. And Georgia, if the Democrat wins the runoff for the Senate, Jim Martin, on December 2nd, I think that's going to be a critical indication that Georgia's turning, that it's flipping. But if it doesn't do it this time, I think we're really maybe one or two cycles away from there. South Carolina, maybe a little longer. But at the end of the day, we could very well, in the none-too-distant future, look at the eastern seaboard of the United States from Maine all the way at the Canadian border down to Key West, and you see all Democratic. Mm-hmm. That it has never happened since the founding of the Republican Party.
And likewise, you could see all across the northern tier of the country, from Maine to Washington State. And we're not far from that either.
Idaho, a little struggle there, but...
You've got to skip over
although,
Idaho.
If I mentioned, Idaho elected a Democrat to Congress this time.
That's right.
They sent a Democratic House member in. So yeah, we are in a... We're going all over. Sounds like a lot of anecdotes, but it goes back to your first core question there, which is, are we in this transformational moment? Clearly, the map tells us yes. The demographics tell us yes. But the way that you create a transformational moment, as opposed to a kind of blip on the radar screen,
yeah,
is what you do policy-wise.
That's right. And John Nichols, our guest today on Media Matters, we've been I'm Bob McChesney, the host. We're talking about the election and politics, and we've been emphasizing so far the strategic. I want to get back to the policy, but before we do, I do want to remind listeners this is a recorded show. We taped it 3 days before going on air, so please don't try to call and just sit back, relax, and enjoy listening to WILL AM 580. And John, I mean, we have not even spoken yet about sort of the three-ton gorilla that's in the world today, which is the economy, the financial crisis, and the economic recession, possible depression.
It started looking awful lot like it.
And it's going to be possibly as defining a period for our children, if not for us, as the Great Depression was for our parents and our grandparents.
It could be. I mean, it'd be different.
Possibly.
Well, it could be. And I'll tell you this. We've created social structures that didn't exist going into the Great Depression, so we won't feel the pain perhaps as much. But it is possible that the transformative impact of this economic moment will be greater. Because remember, you went into the Great Depression with a country of farmers and factory workers. And we came out of the Great Depression with a country of farmers and factory workers.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible that some of these realities do not play, and these are the decisions that are being made right now of, you know, kind of what do we come out of this economic period with. That's why the debate about the auto industry bailout, which has been such it's kind of an odd, quirky debate, is so very important. I grew up in an auto industry town, or near one, Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I'm a strong backer of some kind of bailout, but I don't want to bail out the big three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kenosha was an American Motors town. It was the fourth little one. What I want to bail out is the United Auto Workers Union. I want to bail out the people who make cars and work in the parts suppliers and in the industry throughout, because the fact of the matter is there's no industry in this country where we saw a situation where, again, in the lifetime of some people who are still around, a situation where through labor union organizing, hard work, a lot of commitment and generational commitment to certain industries, you know, grandfather, father, son working and daughter working in an industry, where we took people and whole communities and whole states and made them middle class.
Yeah.
This industry is such a backbone, and there are many, many ways to bail it out. Certainly just throwing money at it is not the answer. But I will tell you, if we don't protect, if we don't end up at the end of this process with an auto industry, I think that it is perhaps the greatest transformation of this moment, because it is unlikely that this country will make things.
Yeah.
You know, it really becomes, and people say, oh, well, there's a Toyota plant in, you know, someplace or something like that. That's just comic. It is a comic argument at the end of the day that an individual BMW plant or Toyota plant somehow keeps this as an industrialized nation. That's just not true.
And, you know, the broader question that frames even this debate over the auto industry is, you know, precisely how will President Obama deal with the recession and depression? Mm-hmm. And one of the great differences between now and 1931 or 1932 is back then almost the entirety of the economics profession, which was largely ignorant of economics at that time, recommended balancing the budget, making the government smaller, getting out of the way of free enterprise, and it turned a recession into a great...
It sounds like the Republican agenda right now.
That's the irony. That was the McCain agenda.
Yeah.
But it was Hoover's economics, and actually Hoover was even smarter than that, and it made a recession or depression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the Keynesian Revolution explained that in a time of severe depression, it takes extraordinary fiscal stimulus and a massive deficit to draw savings into consumption and into investment to get the economy going again. And fortunately today, unlike then, there are a number of Nobel-winning economists, not the least of which Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman.
James Galbraith, who you've had on this show.
Coming up soon. Who are making it clear that we're talking about a fiscal stimulus in the order of $700 or $800 billion starting above what's currently planned. And this is going to be something that's going to be revolutionary if it's done.
Well, I see three stimuluses, actually.
Okay.
And I think that this is how we should think about it. And remember, it's a lot of money, but it's not that much money compared to what would happen if we don't do it. Because remember, if you stall this economy out, if you really stall it out, you take the better part of 250 million people who every day go to work and give roughly 30 to 40% of what they make to the government, right?
Yeah.
We pay taxes. And if you stall this economy out, if you really go into a deep recession, depression, you take 15, 20% of the population, you stop having that come, it's going to be a lot more money lost a lot faster to the government than what it would spend to stabilize. So if we recognize that up front, that spending the money, even into deficit, is not that terrifying a reality compared to what we're up against, then I see three stimuluses. First off, do you stabilize the financial services sector? Yes, we do, because whether we like it or not, we've created a country that lives on credit. So we haven't even begun to deal with the credit card crisis, which is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Paulson's like all over the place, like a ping pong ball on which part of the credit industry he wants to stabilize, banks and, mm-hmm. and insurance companies, whatever. So you get in there and you do that right. That's hard, but something happens there. Two, I think you do need to stabilize basic industries, manufacturing, and not to play the game of saying, oh, we're going to take a few bucks off the financial services stabilization to help the auto industry. No, this is – we need to cut money loose so that we can actually have an industrial policy in this country and say we want industries – and if they're in trouble, they need to modernize. We're going to help them to do that so that we have industries in the 21st century. Finally
– can I interrupt you for one point? I mean, what are our leading – profitable industries for export in the country today?
Well, it's like animal pelts, you know?
No,
I mean,
military weapons.
Oh, it's terrible.
Agricultural products, to some extent, military weapons, and media products.
And some resources, amazingly
but my
enough.
Point
we
is
actually
that
ship out, you know,
all those things we've mentioned are the result of tremendous government policy benefits. Or they are subsidies. We have an industrial policy. Those are the industries that are successful.
Well, and we also have an industrial policy on the other side. We essentially help plants move out of the United States and open elsewhere. So we just have a very screwed up industrial policy, and money, frankly, has to back it up. I mean, there needs to be a stimulus package. It may not have to be as big as the financial services one, but there needs to be money there. And then the final package, and this is really important, maybe the most important of the three stimuli, and that is we have got to bail out local, municipal, county, and state government.
Yeah.
Because every local government in this country is broke. I mean, they're in crisis.
And they're not allowed to run deficits.
They aren't.
Only the
and so what we're going to see is the entire social services network, which is run, you know, at the county and state level, is going to start to crumble in this country.
Recession.
And education starts to – everything we say is important starts to fall apart. And so what we need to do is recognize that the federal government has a necessity to stabilize local and state government education. And one of the best ways to do that is actually a Roosevelt-style infrastructure plan where you cut loose federal money at a per capita basis to school districts, cities, counties, states, and say, this is money to fix your buildings, to retrofit them environmentally and in other ways, to build roads, to build mass transit, to do all the things you need to do. And with that money, you can then free up your capital budget. You can take what you had already budgeted for some of those things, zero that out. You don't have to worry. You got the federal money there to do that. You can put a whole bunch of people to work, and you can free up money to provide the social services and otherwise stabilize your communities through this very bad recessionary period. It's that sort of plan that will actually keep this American engine functioning through this time. If you don't do that, we will see a meltdown that won't have the theater of a Wall Street meltdown, but it will be in every town, village, and city of this country.
And the other issue that apparently the Obama administration plans to ramp up almost immediately is coming up with a health care plan.
Yeah, it looks like they are – all indications are that Obama's more serious about health care than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
Putting Tom Daschle, who wrote a book on health care reform, in charge of Health and Human Services, I mean, Daschle clearly sent a lot of signals. He wants to get going fast
and
on
Teddy
that.
Kennedy's – it's
Teddy Kennedy restructuring. Pursuit. And then the replacement just this week of Congressman John Dingell is head of Energy and Commerce. Energy and Commerce, a badly named committee because it is the healthcare committee. It's the one that actually does Medicaid, Medicare, all this stuff.
They do a lot of stuff over there.
Oh, they're big. That's why it was such a fight. And Henry Waxman, who has come in charge of that committee, is closely aligned with Speaker Nancy Pelosi, also very closely aligned with the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a lot of evidence that the Obama administration wanted Waxman there so that you could have a player on the key committee in the House to begin to move something very serious in healthcare.
And then, John, if you were to look at the next year and standing back, taking a big picture, what are the sort of issues you think, aside from healthcare and economy, that Obama could pursue politically, and it wouldn't kill him to try to do it domestically, but it would also possibly be the sort of stuff that could really be good for the country and also give his administration sort of a distinct identity as a progressive administration.
There's so many things he could do. It's almost, you know, it's like because it's sort of the repair of the Bush
but
disaster.
With the qualification, it's something where, you know, he doesn't have to give up all his political capital or
I would say it. I would just say it. You know, I'd love to restore the Constitution.
Well, actually, that's one of the things.
That's a pretty good area to work in, and it's actually very popular. It polls very well. The one I would pick is farm and food. I would actually say that you know, the Department of Agriculture, people don't understand. The Department of Agriculture is the fourth largest agency within the federal government. It has 110,000 employees, offices across this country, and it has charge of consumer affairs in so many areas, all sorts of foreign aid, all sorts of domestic stimulus, our hunger programs, and of course, then the agricultural programs that go beyond it. If you had a visionary leader there, somebody who was really committed to turning the old Department of Agriculture into a Department of Farms and Food, i.e., with the purpose of making this country a producer of healthy, sustainable food and using all the infrastructure that goes with it in the retail area, I think you could have a very transformative impact, and you can make our kids healthier. You could make our role in the world more functional because of the role in food aid around the planet. You could really regulate a lot of corporations in a lot of ways, and you could go back to a Jeffersonian ideal. You know, Thomas Jefferson said the most important thing in structuring an American democracy is that our land be diversely owned, that we have, you know, small farmers, small business people across this country. You could regenerate that, and I think that's a doable thing.
Any
it would be very popular.
Any sense of whether this is an issue Obama's thought much about or has strong a position
the
on?
The truth of the matter is that Obama's rural policy, and it's one of the reasons he got 45% of the rural vote and won some of these states that Dems don't usually win, was dramatically more detailed and better. He was taking a lot of advice from the National Farmers Union, which is the progressive wing of the farm movement. And we'll see if he plays it out. But this there's no room here for a cautious choice. I mean, that means that you can't have another Clintonite as Secretary of Agriculture. You need
who's kissing up to business while they're mouthing rhetoric.
You need somebody visionary.
Everyone.
You need somebody really good there. And frankly, if I could pick one area where I could say that you know, you do the right stuff, it will yield tremendous benefits practically for the country, but also politically for Obama.
You'd deliver the Dakotas.
It would. This is how you begin to transform the interior West. And you also, this is how you feed poor kids.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about an honorable thing. 30,000 children a day die from starvation on this planet. You restructure some of our policies as regard food and farm aid and things like that, some trade policies, we can save most of those kids. It's as simple as that.
John Nichols, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've only got a few minutes left. Thank you for sticking with us. And again, I apologize you can't call in because we had to tape the show before we get on air. But hope you've enjoyed it nonetheless. John, looking forward, we've already referred to Iraq and Afghanistan. And everything I've read about both situations, especially Afghanistan, but Iraq too, suggests that there is no way for him to have a successful conclusion there. It doesn't basically have us out of there. I mean, ultimately.
I mean, look, the fact of the matter is that Iraq is actually the less ugly of the situations. It's not that the surge worked. It is that you have, frankly, physical realities on the ground.
Well, I mean, everyone in Iraq's united and wants us to leave.
They all want us to leave. Yeah. And frankly, Obama's messages on that are pretty popular there.
Yeah.
And also, Iraq is surrounded by countries that have influence, and much of that influence, despite all the whining about Iran and things like that, is towards stabilizing. So Iraq is a mess, but a mess that can be dealt with. I worry dramatically more about Afghanistan. I think that Obama is on exactly the wrong track there.
Yeah.
And here's the core questions people should ask themselves about Afghanistan. Why is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, running operations in a country that does not border the North Atlantic? It is because the Bush administration wanted to bring Europe in and have this sort of U.S.-European overlay.
Well,
on
this gloss that it's not an American invasion.
Yeah, it's just an absurdity. The fact is we need to leave, and we need to take NATO with us. And the answer for Afghanistan is the United Nations needs to come in there. Now, should we support that? Absolutely. No question of that about it. But we have the exact wrong overlay for stabilizing Afghanistan at this point. And the instability of Afghanistan feeds the instability of Pakistan. And it's just if I could get into Obama's head and say, look, there is one thing you really need to change on. This is the one thing you need to rethink radically. It's this one, because the fact is that nobody who's serious and is on the ground in Afghanistan will tell you that the current structure with NATO and the U.S. running things is working.
You know, it's funny, the great line about Afghanistan, that's where empires go to die.
Absolutely.
You know, we're following the Russians, the Brits, the Greeks.
And there's a great lesson also, too, that in Afghanistan, the Afghans, because of their central location in the world, have been invaded so many times.
Mm-hmm.
They know how to wait. They know how to wait until the empire gets a little tired, or until the empire is stupid enough to infuse lots of troops in, create an authoritarian state where it's clear that the enemy is the foreigner. That's what the Russians did. And it's at that point where you lose any sort of fight for the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. I think we're very close to that right now. And frankly, infusing tens of thousands of additional troops in, including these poor troops who, you know, finally are getting out of Iraq, and then you send them to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Exactly the wrong move.
I mean, that could bring down the whole administration, I would think of it.
Well,
if it billows out of control.
Remember that we started here talking about landslides and that, and we started saying, well, the last guy who had this kind of win was Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah. That's
Lyndon Johnson had the ability to transform the world. He did a lot domestically to transform this country. At the start of the 60s, 20% of Americans lived in poverty. At the end of the 60s, it was down to about 12%. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lyndon Johnson did unbelievably important domestic things, and yet it all crashed and burned, mm-hmm. and really, in many ways, laid the roots for the modern conservative era when he got himself all wrapped up in a little war in Southern Asia.
And, John, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Something you're very written about a lot. You've actually written books on this, the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the claims you made when you wrote your book on impeachment, when you were on the air here and in your talks, was that you can never expect an administration to give back powers it's inherited from previous administrations, no matter what the political party. It's up to Congress. It's up to the people to demand it back. We're going to have to review the Patriot Act and FISA again. Guantanamo, of course, has already been in the news. What is your sense now of how the President Obama regards the question of civil liberties and rolling back the entirety of the Bush attack on the Bill of Rights?
He said very good things during the campaign. In fact, the interesting thing is if he just remembers his biggest applause lines,
mm-hmm.
especially during the primary campaign when he talked about, you know, taking back the Constitution, respecting the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
crowds went wild.
Yeah.
It was bigger than the war. It was bigger than the economic messages. The American people want this. But the fact of the matter is, this is a place where these new Democratic majorities need to push. And the place to begin the push is in the confirmation hearings on Holder, who will very likely be the nominee for Attorney General.
And he, too, has apparently said good things along these lines.
He gave a wonderful speech to the American Constitution Society. It's interesting that the executive director of the American Constitution Society is going to go into the White House now. So there's some very, very good signals that these two constitutional lawyers, Obama and Biden, actually do get a lot of this stuff. But to assume that they are going to give up powers on their own is absurd. There has to be an ask from Congress. They will be easier to ask than mm-hmm. Dick Cheney and George Bush. But if Congress cedes this entire question of the structure of the federal government to the executive branch, the executive branch will retain most of the powers that George Bush and Dick Cheney basically stole through extra constitutional measures and put in that branch.
On that note, John Nichols, I see our time has run out. I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL-AM 580. I'll be back with another episode of Media Matters in 167 hours. Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The Champaign-Urbana area forecast today is calling for mostly sunny skies and a high in the mid-40s. Then tonight we'll have a chance of rain arriving in the overnight hours, low about 35. Tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high around 40. And then on Tuesday we should see mostly sunny skies and a high around 40 once again. Winds today from the south at 8 to 16 miles an hour, the same tonight. This is WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a service of the College of Media at Illinois.
From PRI.